Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City of Arroyo Grande. This is our City Council meeting, and this evening we're also going to be meeting as the successor agency to the dissolved Arroyo Grande Redevelopment Agency. And this is Tuesday, September 23rd. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Here.
Councilmember Costello?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Here. We're very pleased this evening to have John Murphy here from the Rotary Club of Pismo Beach in Five Cities, and John is going to lead us in our flag salute. If you would please remain standing for our invocation. Pastor Eric Swanson is here from Berrien Bible Church to do that for us. John?
Join me in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for being such a good and gracious God to us. You already treat us so much better than we deserve, and we thank you for this. You've called many of us to a position of leadership, either at the city level or at the church, and we thank you for this as well, but we must confess who is worthy of such things. We all fall so far short of your standard. Here, Lord, we can remember your greatest gift to us, how you made us right before you. We want to pause and thank you for your Son, Jesus Christ, whom you sent to die on the cross and rise again, to pay the penalty for our sins and make us right before you. We thank you for the ultimate grace gift. Pray for continued grace upon these men and women tonight as they seek to lead your people at a city level. We pray you give them wisdom so that they may know what is right before you. We pray you give them courage so that they may do what is right before you. Help us all to lead not by what is popular or expedient, but simply by what is right.
And this we sponsor the Interact Club at Arroyo Grande High School. We, along with Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, and Nipomo Clubs, give books to every third grader in every school in the area. We're going to be working Saturday helping to staff the pie-eating contest, so hope everyone shows up for that messy affair. Internationally, we've sponsored projects as far away as Africa, India, Southeast Asia, South America, Mexico, and we have two fundraisers a year, which we invite everyone to participate in. In the spring, we have a golf tournament at the San Luis Obispo Country Club, which funds our foundation. The club has a foundation, which is nonprofit. And every August, we have what we call Summer Sizzle, where we raise monies to help support local charities. And each year, we give at least $15,000 to our local charities. So Rotary is both local and international. We are the largest, by far, service organization in the world with something like 1.2 million members in over 200 different countries and regions. Thank you, sir.
Good. Thank you, John. We appreciate you being here. Okay, moving along on the agenda, item 5 is agenda review. 5A is closed session announcements. Tim, would you take care of that for me tonight?
There is no reportable action, Mayor Farrar.
Okay, thank you. Item 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only, and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. Item 6 is special presentations, and we do have one this evening. Very pleased to have the San Luis Obispo Regional Transit Authority here to talk about something really popular, a potential rate increase for runabout. So we're real pleased to have RTA here this evening, and we'll let you take it away.
Take it from here. Good evening. My name is Tanya Arnold. I'm the CFO and Director of Administration for the San Luis Obispo Regional Transit Authority. I wanted to thank everyone for allowing me to present to you tonight the RTA's plan to collect public input regarding our proposed increase for runabout fares. So I first wanted to provide just a little bit of background. In order to use the door-to-door runabout service, riders must first submit an eligibility application, which has to be signed by a medical professional. The application must demonstrate that the rider is either physically or cognitively disabled, and that prevents him from using the traditional fixed route service. The Americans with Disabilities Act requires that runabout operate during the same hours and within 3/4 of a mile of all fixed route transportation in the county or in the area. So in our in the city of Arroyo Grande, that would be the RTA Route 10 and then the South County Transit Routes 21, 23, and 24. And that's within 3/4 of a mile of those service areas. Now, why? Why are we considering a fare increase? Runabout fares currently only cover about 4% of the annual operating costs of that service. We project this figure to be even less over time as demand continues to increase for the service. This is especially challenging since ADA prohibits us from turning down trips requests even during peak travel periods. We can have no trip denials. In order to assure we stay in compliance with ADA regulations, we need more funding, or we will be forced to cut back any and all transit services within the county, starting with evening and weekend services. And it needs to be a countywide effort to cut services, because just cutting local service only cuts a small portion. It'll be countywide. So RTA is proposing to set runabout fares at twice the fixed route cash fare, which is expressly permitted in the ADA, which is consistent with the practice most transit agencies use across America. The runabout proposed runabout fare cap would be $10 in order to minimize the financial impact of the riders who travel long distances within our county. As you know, we provide transportation from Paso all the way down to Santa Maria and within the five cities, so there are some very, very long trips within our county. This is far lower than what you would pay for a taxi cab, ride on, or other long-distance door-to-door transportation that's provided within the county. And the proposed fare increase would take effect, if adopted, on February 1st of 2015. So what are we doing to seek comments? Can be submitted to RTA via email, letter, phone call. And we'll take those summarized comments and present them to the RTA Board of Directors at the November 5th meeting. And at that time, the RTA Board will consider the RTA or the runabout fare increase. And at this time, I'd like to ask that the Arroyo Grande community members contact RTA directly or attend one of these three public workshops to discuss how the runabout fare increase would affect them. I also ask that you forward any comments you receive to RTA or Mayor Farrar, who represents the City of Arroyo Grande, on the RTA Board of Directors. Thank you for allowing me to present this information to you.
Okay, thank you, Tanya. Any questions for Tanya?
I do.
Go ahead.
What's the economic strata of the typical person that you serve?
We serve a wide variety of riders. They're seniors, disabled, but keep in mind everyone who qualifies for runabout either has a physical or cognitive disability, so a lot of them are on limited income.
I guess that's my point, is we're doing a rather large increase for somebody on fixed income. Do they have any way to subsidize the increase so that they're not?
There's a lot of information here, and I can't get into all the details
right,
in this limited amount of time.
Right.
But we really encourage people to look at their individual trips, because although some of the impacts are quite significant, a lot of the city-to-city trips, it's a very, very minimal, in most cases, 25 cents of an increase.
I just noticed the trip from San Luis to Grover Beach is 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some particular reason for that?
It's based on how the fare structure has been developed, with all the different regional systems, and so the fares that we've done fare increases both to the RTA and the South County system, and those fare increases, we have not gone back and asked the runabout at those times. So it's been since 2008 that we've done a fare increase for this group.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
On the chart here, there's you don't list Roy Grande as an origin or a destination. You do pick up. It's just not the top 14.
Yeah, we took the top 14 origin and destinations, and we really wanted to show those in detail. But at the public workshops, and we have available if anyone wants to call and get that information, we have tables with every possible combination of different locations within the county as far as what those impacts would be.
Okay, thank you for that.
All right. Tanya, thanks so much for making the trip down. Okay, that takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions, and this is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on matters not published on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your comments brief, 3 minutes or less. Please address the council as one body. Who would like to go first tonight?
Hello, my name is Sean Cosgrove. I'm the president of the Aurora Grande Police Officers Association. First, on behalf of the association, I would like to thank the public for their support. Second, I would like to address the notion that the POA will be involved in selecting an investigator for the independent investigation. The POA will not participate in this process. It is not the duty of the police to investigate personnel matters or policy violations of our city leaders. All we ask is that the selection process, all communications, and the investigation itself be made completely public so that everyone can determine for themselves what the truth is. It must be recognized that certain members of this council have chosen to prejudge the so-called investigation and have already predetermined what the outcome should be. The only way to address this conflict is through transparency. I'd like to address a few issues that need clarity. It is apparent that the City Council does not understand. The Council has stated that there were no violations of policy during this incident. This is wrong. The Council has made statements that our actions are fueled by labor negotiations. This is wrong. This Council has publicly come to the conclusion that the independent investigation will result in the same outcome. This is presumptive and irresponsible to conclude. Council has expressed concern over the cost of this investigation. The truth is, the investigation costs will be nothing compared to the cost of lawsuits due to hostile work environment, sexual harassment, and unfair and disparaging treatment of our employees. This is bigger than the City Hall incident. The actions of the City Council by publicly dismissing this issue far exceeds the act by the City Manager. Following members of our Police Officers Association will read the prepared statement. Thank you.
Motion of inappropriate. Stating something inappropriate is a conclusion derived from the interpretation of facts. The officers were told to document the facts. They did as they were instructed and documented just the facts. The officers refrained from documenting any interpretation of the facts or their opinions because it was against what they were directed to do. At no time did anyone ask the officers, "Did you observe anything inappropriate?" Because then it would be the officer's interpretation of the facts. Even in their interviews, the officers were never asked to interpret the facts or ask if they saw anything inappropriate. They were never asked additional information or to draw conclusions about what they observed based on their training and experience as professional police officers. Had they been asked to provide this information in a complete and thorough investigation, I would think we would be having a very different conversation. But since those interviews were not recorded, I guess we will never know.
Hello, my name is Shane Day. I'm a member of the POA Association and a previous president. You assert that no other investigation is not likely to produce any new information. This is premature and irresponsible. Unless you have already predetermined the outcome. The initial investigation was informal, inadequate, and not based on all the evidence available. Another investigation is not likely to produce any new information. How can you make a statement like that and still claim that you are seeking the truth? You state our letter of no confidence serves no purpose. On the contrary, it serves every purpose. As this incident progressed, we waited and waited and waited for a complete thorough and formal investigation into the misconduct of Mr. Adams. We even waited while our citizens demanded that this be done. Only when it was clear that you had no intention of seeking the truth and holding those responsible accountable, we were forced to come forward. This is the last thing we wanted, and you have forced us into an extremely uncomfortable position.
Good evening. My name is Michael Martinez, and I am the Vice President of the Arroyo Grande Police Officers Association. Most importantly, in your letter, you wrote, and I quote, "If there is additional information that the five officers are not sharing, we would encourage them to step forward." This statement is insulting. More than once now, you have pointed fingers at the officers instead of taking accountability and holding those responsible accountable. In this statement, you are insinuating officers are dishonest and withholding information. This is untrue and extremely offensive. We documented the facts as directed and expected a thorough, complete, and formal misconduct investigation would be conducted. We anticipate such an investigation would include all additional evidence, such as the missing internal City Hall security camera footage that just finally resurfaced, and not just relying on one set of facts, one piece of the puzzle. All available evidence should have been sought out, discovered, and documented so the appropriate disciplinary actions could have taken place. You don't conduct a real investigation by sitting back and hoping witnesses come forward. You go out and seek those witnesses. Finally, you stated, "There are some in the community that are apparently not satisfied with just the statements of the officers." Again, this is a clear misdirection on your part if you interpret our officers' reports as evidence that nothing inappropriate occurred. This is insulting to everyone who has had the courage to step forward. A large part of our community are satisfied with the officer's statements and are clearly supporting that we did our job properly and reported the facts. However, a large part of our community are not satisfied with the actions or inactions and the inadequate investigation with the inadequate conclusions. For the last several council meetings, our citizens have come forward and demanded you conduct a formal outside investigation into this matter. You refused. Only after the Police Officers Association issued the vote of no confidence did you suddenly think it was important enough to address
with that subordinate employee, as claimed by Mr. Adams, was dismissed as just bad judgment. I think our community would agree that this is far more than bad judgment and amounts to misconduct as defined in Section 12, Employee Responsibilities and Benefits, Subsection D, Behavior. A summary of some of the policies, Item 1, Conduct by an employee not connected with the employee's official duties that brings a discredit to the city or affects the ability to perform the employee's duties. Not only is it clear that the initial incident has brought discredit to the city, but the subsequent actions and inactions in the days and weeks following the incident also brought even more discredit to the city. How can anyone assert that the city manager's ability to perform his duties has not been affected by this incident? Under subsection F, improper or unauthorized use of city vehicles or equipment, a public building easily falls into this category, and at the very least, to use City Hall as a sobering center as described by Mr. Adams, is clearly inappropriate. Subsection L, any action that is direct hindrance to the effective performance of city functions. We could continue, but I think the point has been made. These were policy violations in 1995, and they are policy violations now. The most concerning thing is how our city council and the city management do not believe or admit these obvious policy violations occurred.
Hello, my name is Michael Smiley, and I'm a member and past president of the Arroyo Grande Police Officers Association. Dishonesty. As police officers, we are taught from day one in the police academy that if you're dishonest, you will be fired. Again, some examples, but not a comprehensive list. Mr. Adams' statement to the officer when he asked the whereabouts of Mrs. McClish. His response, why would she be here? She was standing easily 10 feet away behind his office door. But only he admitted her presence to the officers when one of them walked past him and towards the office. Is this dishonest? How about the missing internal City Hall security camera video footage that finally resurfaced last Friday, 2.5 months later? One might construe that as dishonest. Or even something just as simple as the lights. When the officers arrived, they stated the lights in the building were off. This included the city manager's office. In one of the statements made by the assistant city attorney, Mr. Adams said the lights were on. Well, it seems to me someone is lying. The answer was discovered when this missing internal City Hall camera video footage suddenly resurfaced. We believe these dishonest statements and more would have been discovered if anyone had been interested in discovering the truth. Therefore, the Arroyo Grande Police Officers Association still stands by our vote of no confidence. The Arroyo Grande Police Officers Association intends to continue to pursue any and all available options to have an investigation into not only the initial incident, but the more concerning and now more important lack of appropriate investigation and hasty dismissal of the obvious misconduct and dishonesty. Thank you again to everyone who has supported our officers and our association during this incident that we did not create but now are being forced to deal with. Thank you.
My name is Otis Page. I live at 606 Myrtle Street in Arroyo Grande. This afternoon, I submitted an email to the council, which I wish to read tonight. The subject is the reinvestigation approved by the council in closed session on September 20th. Since the complaint to the grand jury has been fulfilled, we asked for a reinvestigation. We have been advised by the Office of the District Attorney, who we wrote, it will not interfere at this time because of the decision by the council on September 20th. This letter strongly recommends that the council request that the Office of the District Attorney select the investigating attorney and that neither members of the attorney, Tim Connell, invoke Government Code 5497 to establish closed sessions in the general meeting September 9 and the special meeting of September 20. He ignored the quest of an open meeting on the substance and transparent process of the matter, using an apparent legal gimmick. Carmel authored the following for the agendas for the regular meeting on September 9 and the special meeting on September 10, Public Employee Performance Evaluation, pursuant to Government Code 54957, titled City Manager. This law, 54957, used by Carmel, was inappropriately applied. It was not a true personal performance evaluation. Adams was personally judged by the counsel as having only been indiscreet immediately following the original investigation by Carmel's legal associate back in July 8th. Now, I understand I'm exceeding my 3 minutes.
No, you've got about another 30 seconds, Otis. Go ahead.
Well, let me cut it off then. For anybody who wants to read this statement, all you have to do is go to Cal Coast News. I remind you, they are the people who exposed this on August 19th. I am suggesting, and here's the net of it, we want an independent attorney selected by the district attorney, not by members of this council, and not by Council Carmel. You all have, particularly Carmel, unclean hands. And we don't trust you. So we want... I personally stand here reluctantly about this, but you got to understand the rubber meets the road, and we want an independent counsel to administer the judgment from these police officers who have been disparaged by this council. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Next speaker, please. Who's next?
My name is Vanessa Andrews, and I am a resident of Arroyo Grande. I'm a former police officer with the city of Arroyo Grande. I know this kind of situation all too well. A lot of what the officers have already come up here and stated, I firmly believe in. In fact, I was going to bring it all up myself. The investigation was horrendous because there was no investigation. I don't think we even need a new investigation. We have the statements of these officers. It is in direct conflict with what Mr. Adams has stated. I only know what Mr. Adams has stated through his interview with KSBY TV News. What he said is not what they reported. What they reported was the truth. That's what happened. And instead of it being, if it was an attack on Mr. Adams or trying to discredit him as it was suggested in that interview, they could have arrested him that night. You did violate the law. When you lie to a police officer, that's a violation of the Penal Code, 148. We all know it so well, the police community. Could have arrested him right then on the spot for lying about Mrs. McClish even being in that building. Not to mention the fact that if they had taken him for his word, they would have gone on with their police duty, which was attempting to locate a woman who was missing with a medical condition. That would have involved even more officers, more time, more money spent because of a lie. Yet, that's okay. The public didn't even know about any of this until it was revealed by that fringe, you know, outfit out there. And I felt that appalling. And then we didn't even get the full story. We got bits, we got pieces, we got this, we got that. But none of it came together. You know, the complete story. Then we luckily got the memos that these officers wrote. Normally on a police call, when you go out and you write paper, it becomes a public record. But again, if they were out to get Mr. Adams, they would have made it a public record. They would have made it a public incident report. But they didn't do that. Yet their credibility, five of them, is put into question. I saw him shaking his head the whole time they were reading. No, no, that's not true. Yes, it is. He serves at your pleasure.
Okay, anyone else?
Aaron Hinkle, 196 South Alpine here in AJ. I have a couple of things. Recently, I went online to try to find out what the expenses, the travel expense reimbursement rates are for public officials representing the city of Arroyo Grande when they're out on business. I couldn't find anything on the webpage. I don't know if we have anything officially or not. If we do, in the spirit of being transparent, I would like to see it up on the webpage. If we don't, I think we need to do something about it. It shouldn't be any more than what the federal guidelines are, and I've seen receipts supposedly that imply very large amounts for dinner for three individuals, somewhere around $180 for a dinner, which as a government employee, and that's about $60 a person. I know I don't get that. So I'd like that to be looked into. On a whole note that most of us are here for, I stand behind our police department. I wish you did. All of you. Mr. Mayor, you think everything's going to be the same. If it's not, will you resign? Along with the other council members that thought nothing was happening? I request you guys all resign if something is found out to be true. Because you guys are very adamant that nothing happened and there was nothing to be done. Very adamant. And I think you need to stay out of the press and let everybody figure it out without your guys slanting anything. Anybody. Just let it come out. Let the investigation go. Don't have anybody on any of this picking out anybody for it. It should be totally independent from any of you. Even Mr. Brown and Mr. Costello, who actually supported it wholeheartedly. The city attorney involved? Please. That's a joke. This is a disgrace to this city. Let's get to the end of this now and end it. But I do request that you guys all resign that think everything's just hunky-dory and nothing ever happened if something is found out to be true.
Thanks for your comments. Who is next? By the way, Mr. Hinkle, I'm not sure it's on the webpage, but we do have travel expense claim rates, and they mirror the feds. So we'll get it back up.
Patty Welsh, Arroyo Grande. I don't understand how there was a decision to have an investigation when this was never put on the agenda. There was no 24-hour notice, and the residents were not given a chance to speak on this issue prior to the council stating an investigation was done, and you were found doing no wrong. I think our police department should demand the city's law firm or any other person on this council not be the ones to decide who will be the independent investigator when it appears the Brown Act was not followed to start with. I think the city and the law firm who represents them need to recuse themselves from the process from this point forward. I think this should be turned over to the district attorney's office to find who will do what is needed, so there is no doubt it was an independent investigation. I also ask, until the investigation is finished and a final report in writing is given, if Mr. Adams leaves his employment with the city for any reason, he not be given the golden parachute. And how did this whole incident get out to the news agencies? Not by the city council, not by City Hall, that's for sure. If you had your ways, we would still not be aware of it. I believe it was an employee who is sick and tired of what has been going on, and they leaked it to the press. If I'm right, kudos to you for bringing this cover-up to our attention. In closing, I would like to state that because the acceptable behavior is up for interpretation, so is the truth. But the truth is based on fact, and the truth cannot be changed to fit somebody's desires or needs. All we are asking for is the truth. Thank you for reconsidering the independent investigation, and I, too, stand behind our police department.
Okay, very good. Next.
Hello, my name is Michael Andrews. I've lived here in Arroyo Grande for 15 years now. Every day I go through this village, I drive back and forth, and I left busy Orange County to come up here. And I love this village. I am so happy to be in our little small community. But I have to tell you, I've been driving back and forth now the last 4 weeks, and there's a definite stain on City Hall. In the words of Chief...
It's unacceptable. I have no confidence in the City Council, the City Manager's Office, or the City Attorney's Office. And know this, I will not vote for you, and I will not vote for your charter initiative.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
My name is Beatrice Spencer. I'm a resident of Arroyo Grande. This is going to shock you, but I was going to be nice. I wanted to thank the council for reversing your decision and agreeing to have the independent investigation. I know we're all still very skeptical as to what brought that about, and I don't think we need to kid ourselves. We think this is what brought that about. I think this private residents, the citizens, could have screamed and yelled until we were blue in the face, and nothing was going to happen until these guys took a stand. And so we want to thank them for that, because if nothing else... Give the people a break on the clapping just for tonight. I think I wanted to just kind of, you know, with me it always comes down to groceries or kids. So that's what you're going to get. The reason why people are still so upset, and you can probably all relate to this, I think you all have kids. You know how you badger your kids to go clean their room? Clean your room, clean your room. You know it's the right thing, you need to clean your room. Finally, they decide to go clean their room. And they come out, and they can't understand why you're not happy that they finally cleaned the room. And a lot of us feel like you guys should have known to clean your room on your own, without us having to badger you, without there being a divide in the city. We've got residents that are for, residents that are against. Why does it have to get to where we pit each other against one another? If you people would have done the right thing, and at least considered the fact that there are other people who vote for you besides Mr. Adams, and Ms. McClish doesn't even live in the city, but your responsibility is not just to one employee. It is to the rest of the people who have to work there when you make an exception to a pretty big rule. I pulled up the personnel regulations for the city of Arroyo Grande. It's a 68-page document. I didn't need to go past page one. On page one, it says, the purpose of the regulation shall be to establish a system of uniform personnel policies and procedures to maintain and improve the quality of city personnel practices consistent with blah, 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 blah. We'll go down to number three. Assurance of impartial treatment of applicants and employees in all aspects of personnel administration, including but not limited to blah, 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 discipline and termination. So I think we're still at a loss as to understand how the decision that you made is impartial, how it doesn't show favoritism towards one or two employees, when we all know that if anyone, even the janitor, would have been caught drinking tea in city offices after hours in the dark when the police responded and they didn't answer the door, would not have just been reprimanded. They would have been terminated. So again, we appreciate the fact that you have reversed course. I know that's not an easy decision for you to make. No one likes to have to change their mind on something they're pretty dead set against in the first place. But we appreciate you taking another opportunity to at least help us understand why you chose to do what you did. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Heather Jensen, Arroyo Grande resident. And I'm here to also commend the AGPD POA for their strong stance of you, a united force in bringing this to the public and to the City Council. It took a lot of guts, and I think we all appreciate that. But I am here tonight to address your decision on Saturday to reopen the investigation. But I can only think it was kind of like a good news and bad news. The good news was that you thought an independent investigation was a good move. However, the way it is stated in your statements, that is not a good news, because to have two of your city council people actually be the people that would select a business or an individual to do the investigation is like a fox in the hen house. I mean, we can't accept that. And even though there may be some not unanimous opinion on the city council, right now because of an attorney or a sheriff's office in this county or another county, but someone independent of our city, so that the city council and current staff are not part of selecting an independent investigator. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Bob Lund, 1202 Linda Drive. On a different note, I want to talk a little bit about the Harvest Festival coming up this weekend. It's the 77th annual Harvest Festival for this community. It's something that draws us together, and it's a wonderful event. And as part of that, I want to give thanks to some of the people that have made this thing really happen. The Roy Grandy Kiwanis, Glenn Herman and Specialist Entertainment, Curtis Reinhardt, the Agricultural Pavilion, David and Judy Hirsch, the vendor booths, Terry Levers, and thanks for the support of Public Works, Jeff English and his staff, and thanks to Steve Adams for volunteering all his free time for running this whole thing and making it happen, and to many, many others that make this a great public event. Also, we have a Rio Grande in Bloom that will have a booth in the Agricultural Pavilion, be selling flowers as a fundraiser, and we hope you all join us there. I want you all to know that nine of us are going to Philadelphia for our annual American in Bloom Symposium. We all pay our own way, and it's in support of this great community. At Rio Grande Public Art, we'll be selling a mock-up of that wonderful mural that's on the Roberts Restaurant. I don't know if you can see this, but these will be available for sale for the public art as a fundraiser. And we have many more things happening in public art. The next project is going to be a Chumash Arbor Glyph. And we're putting that process through the city shortly because it's going to be an 8-foot oak tree sponsored by the Chumash Indian Tribe. And it's going to cost about $6,350. Good news is we got a grant from the Community Foundation for $5,000. So we're looking to raise another $1,350 for improving the city once again. So thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Anyone else?
Hi, my name is Colleen Martin, 855 Olive Street. I've been thinking this week a lot about my dad, because my dad really loved this city, and he knew all of you, all of you. His name was Mike Titus, and he and I worked really hard on the general plan for this city. And we've always been really, really proud of Aurora Grande and really tickled that Aurora Grande was where we're from. And I was never willing to move to Pismo Beach or Grover. I always had to have my address be in Aurora Grande. It's been troubling the last few weeks. But I want to share with you two things I learned from my dad, and maybe you can take his advice on as you move forward from tonight. First off, as my dad was dying, I learned one thing, and I was almost 50. That I can't change anyone else. You can't change anyone else. You're only responsible for your own behavior. You, Mr. Guthrie, you, Mr. Brown, you, Mr. Castelli, you're only responsible for your own behavior. You can't change anyone else, even though you may like to. You're responsible for your own behavior. Secondly, I learned that yesterday happened. Yesterday's over. There's nothing you can do about yesterday. But what I'm telling you as a governing body of our city, you can move forward tonight by doing the right thing, okay? We can't change yesterday. We never can. And on the school board, I've had difficult, horrible situations just like you're in. But I can tell you, you need to move forward with the best interests of the city involved. And part of that is looking at how you've treated people. So please, we want to feel good about our city again. We do. And we're hoping you will create that feeling for us. And the way you do that is by acting. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Julie Tacker, and I guess I would be considered fringe support. And what I want to say tonight is that I think you've either had bad advice or you're part of the bad advice to your fellow council members. You do have a closed session item tonight, again, evaluating the performance of Mr. Adams. And I would expect, don't you? Well, you should. And I guess I expected out of each of these closed sessions that...
You had us looking there for a minute.
Yeah, well...
Julie, but no, we don't.
Okay. But each time, we should have heard a report out that said he was on administrative leave. And to come back and have an independent investigation. And you didn't do that. Instead, you canceled the meeting of July 22nd. This didn't get visited... again, until after the fringe media picked up a story. So I understand that you've reversed your decision to do an independent investigation, but what I didn't hear is that that investigation will include the facts after the incident and that the cover-up and who was involved and what bad advisor you've had will also be revealed. So I wish you well. This is painful. But this afternoon I looked at your organizational chart, and you answer to the people of Arroyo Grande. And that is all. And until this is resolved, that's all you can focus on, is these people that live here and expect a good outcome so that you can heal. And I do wish you well.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Council, Cynthia Lewis here, Arroyo Grande. My only question is, how are we as citizens to have confidence in our council when the people that we trust with our lives do not have confidence in you? It's not about the cover-up at this point. It's about everything else. It's everything from July 3rd on. I don't believe any of you have been forthcoming with everything that happened from July 3rd on. And going back to the personnel regulations, improper conduct, any action including attitude or behavior that is a direct hindrance to the effective performance of city functions. How can Mr. Adams at this point be doing a top-notch job in his position with this hanging over his head? If any other employee of the city had been in that building during off hours, they'd be gone. We just hope you do the right thing.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Let the sirens go by. Good evening. My name is April McLaughlin, and I am an Arroyo Grande resident. I'll be brief. The problem isn't sitting behind me. The problem isn't sitting over here. It started here, but it's on your shoulders. The problem now sits in front of us. And we hope that you guys do the right thing for the city. And I hope the day doesn't come that you ask Mr. Adams not to come in tonight because of the pressure you guys are all under, like you did Mrs. McClish, and the reason that she's not here. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening, Lindy Owen. I drove up from Los Osos. Thanks to the fringe media, Cal Coast News, I have been following this story. The reason I came to speak tonight is because it's a very familiar story. In Los Osos, we had an affair that affected the outcome of the most expensive public works project in the county, and it was covered up. And it was basically looked at by county council and dismissed We should have had an outside investigation. There were serious claims and things that did occur, and it went away, and we ended up with some problems resulting from that cover-up. So, and then I understand that Mr. Adams was part of the termination of a police officer who was having an affair with somebody in personnel, and it just occurred to me that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If he cannot, I mean, I don't know why you think that it's okay to fire other people yet involve yourself in that same behavior and then not feel the need to step down. I also am concerned with Mayor Ferraro's issues with the John Wallace Association, and I follow that very clearly with your sanitary district, his overcharging, his many illegal steps that went there. Again, your legal counsel cleared him of any wrongdoing there. So I beg for you to get an outside independent investigation going, and I don't know why you all involved yourselves in the cover-up, but I think you should stop listening to your mayor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
The right investigator and see it through.
Well, they're all out of county. We've not had any contact with them before, so that's our starting point.
Yes, sir.
So if you change your mind somewhere along the way, let us know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, all right. Public comment is closed. Okay, we're going to move on to item 8, consent agenda. This is normally a group of items that the council approves in one motion, unless there is an item on consent that a member of the council would like to pull for further consideration, independent action, or clarification. This is also an opportunity for members of the public to come forward on any of the consent items. And this evening we're going to be addressing consent items 8A through 8J. So if there's anyone in the audience who would like to come forward and comment on any of those items, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Anyone? Okay, seeing no one, we'll close the public comment portion of the consent agenda. What is the will of the council this evening? Anyone?
8C.
Any item?
8C. 8C.
D. David?
No, C.
Charlie.
C. Charlie. Okay. Any others?
No, I want that's the same one for me.
Okay. I was going to comment on that as well. So I'll entertain a motion to approve consent items 8A through 8J with the exception of 8C.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any other comments? Hearing none, roll call, please.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. Councilmember Barnidge, HC.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just had a question, Steve, on this as far as, and I think we talked briefly on the phone about the grants for $75,000. Just we had someone email us and was in support of it, but he couldn't be here tonight. And if you could just, in a short Cliff Note version, just sort of explain what we're going forward with and what how the agency, you know, agencies that are going to be involved and what the study is going to look at.
I'm not the best expert on this. I can just give you a brief summary. We're partnering with South County Sanitation District on this project. It's a little different than the other projects we've talked about where we are concurrently looking at efforts to do a recycled project at around somewhere with the treatment plant that would partner with all the other agencies. This one is upstream, so it's in Rio Grande. It would just be our effluent that it would be treating before it got to the treatment plant and then being able to use for our uses. The grant is a feasibility study that would look at a number of issues in terms of environmental issues and feasibility issues. We have identified some general areas where we think it would work in terms of providing the drainage necessary or providing the soil and the different conditions necessary. So the study would look at that and permitting and a number of other issues. As far as the funds you're approving this evening, it both includes the money for the consultant to do what's necessary to submit for the grant, and then it also includes the matching funds for the grant.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. That's my only question.
I just had a question. It talks about 500 to 600 acres feet per year. I'm trying to figure out what's the use of that going to be. Is it recharge water, or what is it?
At this point, it's intended to be recharge water, but there are other potential uses. It could be used as non-potable irrigation water. It could be used as a wedge to prevent saltwater intrusion. So there are a number of very useful, particularly under current circumstances, purposes for that water.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to make a comment on that. And I wanted to really thank Rick Sweet and Shannon Sweeney from the Sanitation District. This was actually a brainchild of Shannon's. And as many of you know, we've been talking about a recycled project out at the plant. And number one, there isn't physical room out there for one. And, of course, it's in the coastal zone and in the flood zone. And so the reason why we're focusing on one trunk line is because Arroyo Grande has the largest one, and I think it's roughly 800,000 gallons a day that it verges into the sanitation lot. There's the governor just signed it, and not too long ago, and it is going to move forward. So we'll see what happens in November with it. But by November, we want to have something that may not be shovel ready, but it'll be close to it. And then that would put us in a better position in the queue for any funding that might come available through the water bond if it's passed. So that's the rest of the story on that. Anybody want to make a motion on 8C?
I'll move for approval.
Second.
Okay. All right. We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Okay, moving on to item 9. This is our first public hearing this evening. This is consideration of an ordinance amending Municipal Code Section 9.04.020. Excuse me. And this is in relation to alcoholic beverages at Farmer's Market. Kelly, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. I proposed as an amendment to the city's Municipal Code and two conditional use permits to allow the sale of bottled wine and wine tasting at existing farmers markets located in the parking lots of Olihan Alley and in front of Smart and Final on East Grand Avenue. The San Luis Obispo County Farmers Market Association currently operates a Wednesday morning farmers market in the parking lot in front of Smart and Final and a Saturday afternoon farmers market in the parking area of Olihan Alley in partnership with the Village Improvement Association. As background, a State Assembly Bill 2488 was passed in July of this year that allows certified farmers markets to provide wine tasting subject to specific conditions. Currently, our farmers markets do not allow the sale of bottled wine, so the applicant requests that both the sale of wine and those tastings be approved as part of the two conditional use permit amendments. The municipal code must also be amended to allow the sale of wine in Olihan Alley. So the conditions of the new law state that a licensed wine grower, a member of the licensee's family, or an employee of the licensee may conduct bottled wine sales and an instructional wine tasting for consumers at a certified farmer's market subject to the authorization of managerial control of the operator of the certified farmer's market. Number two, at all times during an instructional tasting event, the instructional tasting event area shall be separated from the remainder of the market by a wall, rope, cable, cord, chain, fence, or any other type of permanent or temporary barrier. Only one licensee may conduct an instructional tasting event during the operation hours of any one of these farmers markets. The licensee shall not permit any consumer to leave the instructional tasting area with an open container of wine. The licensee shall not pour more than 3 ounces of wine per person per day. And finally, no premium gift, free goods, or other thing of value shall be given away by an authorized licensee or its designated representative in connection with the instructional wine tasting. All of these conditions are included in the resolution approving the conditional use permit amendments. Now, the proposed amendment to Title IX of the Municipal Code simply adds Olihan Alley to the list of city-owned properties where alcohol consumption is allowed. It should be noted that the conditional use permit amendments would not take effect until after the effective date of the ordinance amending this particular section. So this slide shows where the wine tasting and sales are proposed for the Wednesday Farmers Market out in front of Smart and Final, and that area is shown in red. And then this one is for the Saturday Farmers Market over in Olihan Alley, again shown in red. Staff is in favor of these amendments since it would help the overall success of farmers markets within the city, which supports the city's general plan policies of supporting local agriculture. Last month, the Planning Commission made a recommendation to Council to adopt an ordinance and approve the conditional use permit amendments to allow wine tasting at local farmers markets with an added condition that there not be a charge for the wine tasting. The reasoning was basically to deter wineries from exceeding that 3 ounce limit, meaning that they are less likely to provide more than 3 ounces if wine is free to patrons. The applicant has submitted a request to reverse this condition and allow a charge for tasting.
Do you plan on policing this? Are they expecting the city to police this?
No, it really is up to the Farmers Market Association to do the policing of this.
And what would be the direct outcome of someone violating this?
Ooh, good question. I guess they could. Yeah, I know that the applicant is in the audience. I think maybe he might be able to address some of these questions better than I, or at least that particular question. Thank you.
I'll wait until he comes up and talks.
Any other questions?
No.
Yeah, I wondered about the liability insurance they would have to carry because of Councilman Costello's comments. I don't think it's reasonable to think that we're going to have all those people and we're always going to have everything go smoothly. There's probably going to be some issue or some event at some point in time, and I just want to make sure the city's not holding the bag, so to speak. So are they going to have some levels of insurance to cover those types of events?
I believe they do, but again, I would defer to the applicant for the specifics.
So you didn't talk about what the requirements might be?
For the liability insurance?
Or even Joe's question. Did those things get talked about with the applicant?
They were not brought up during Planning Commission.
I find it surprising that those issues didn't come up earlier, but those are my questions, Mr. Mayor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The city manager just informed me that we do have insurance for farmers market associations.
Yeah, but what I'm asking is, does this particular applicant have additional insurance?
Additional insurance, yeah, I would ask the applicant.
Well, I should come up in just a second. So,
I think all, let's see, I can probably ask all my questions of the applicant.
All right. Was that it then? Okay. Then we will have the applicant come forward, and hopefully you can address some of the questions. Come on.
Like to thank the City Council and all the city staff for all of the work and efforts, and I think this is a
might want to get a little closer to that mic there and get your name for the record.
Okay. So my name is Peter Janke. I'm the administrator of the San Luis Obispo County Farmers Market Association, which is a 501c6. Always get that mixed up, but anyway, so it's a public benefit corporation. So I don't know if you want me to start just responding to certain questions, or do you want me to just...
Go ahead and share with us what you wanted to share, and then we'll get to the questions.
Okay, so, excuse me, I did send out an email to all of you, the council members, and then also city staff, and so I'm basically reiterating what that is. So we feel that we're fully capable of enforcing all of the components of AB 2488. And so here are some of the items. So first of all participating wineries would be required to sign an FMA, that's us, letter of understanding detailing the conditions of participation. So right away, they have to agree to all of the conditions. The FMA manager, that's again, will place a sign. Tasting is limited to 3 ounces per person, and that would be placed conspicuously on the table where the winery would be serving the wine tasting. Number three is that the FMA manager will periodically monitor the winery activity during the farmer's market. So one person can't be at all one place for the whole time, so we feel that periodic going through and then would definitely be helpful. Number four is, should a winery violate any of the conditions, the FMA would report the violation to the ABC, that's Alcoholic Beverage Control, and would disallow the offending winery's participation at any of the farmers markets, certified farmers markets. We also feel, as was already brought up, that these are reputable businesses, and they're not likely to tarnish their reputation and their good standing by knowingly violating a law such as AB 2488. So we feel that these conditions or these actions would be able to enforce AB 2488. All aspects.
Did you want to ask your question about it?
I have a question, Joe. Did you want to go?
Well, I'll just, you know, I went back and checked over your email, and I believe you're saying that you'll report the, if one of the wineries...
Wrong tree, but it's at least something you should look into, I think.
Well, I certainly will.
Thank you.
Okay. Yep, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Peter, it's one winery per market, correct?
Correct.
Okay, good, because I didn't see how they'd keep track of that as far as the 3 ounces. Okay, and then I got my measuring cup out at home because I wasn't exactly sure. So how many tastings would you say are in 3 ounces? Is that like three tastings? Do you know?
That's my understanding is that in talking to friends of mine who go to wine tastings and the like, and my understanding is that it's about 1 ounce per taste. Okay. And so the reason I would believe, but can't say it's because it's my own opinion, is that the reason for 3 ounces is that we allow the market patron to be able to taste three different wines that would be presented.
Okay. And then So do you manage any farmers markets that do this already, that serve alcohol, that serve tastings?
We have at our San Luis Obispo Saturday morning farmers markets, we have had tastings there once per year for the past several years, and we've seen no problems whatsoever.
Okay. And the people that will be giving the tastings and collecting the money, they're going to be obviously carding the people. It'll be ID and carding the people. They will be people that work for the winery, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, those are my only questions. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, you have the one state. if you have one winery, is it one winery for the whole year? Are you rotating the winery?
Oh, I see. So I don't know if I should. I realize that there's a lot going on with, and so I just put here as a little bit of a recruitment. So please be patient. It'll go pretty quick. So first of all, we will be posting notices in newsletters of three different winery associations from San Luis Obispo into Santa Barbara County. We will post a notice on our website. In fact, we will have a means to recruit so that people can then contact us directly in terms of excuse me, in terms of their interest in answering questions that they might have. And then any interested wineries would be scheduled on a rotational basis.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. All right, this is a public hearing. If there's any member of the audience who would like to come forward and comment on this item, this would be your opportunity. Anyone?
Be sure to pull that microphone down, Minetta.
I'm not prepared for this at all. I didn't think about it. Pardon me. I'm Minetta Bennett. I live at 415 Allen Street, Arroyo Grande. Lived there forever. And I object to, especially to the one, the local one on Olahan Alley. I think it is entirely too small an area for a farmer's market with wine tasting. And I believe a few years ago, I believe some new grower wanted to get into the farmer's market, and they were told they couldn't. And so it went before the city, and then there were new regulations. So I do not want a wine tasting room going in, wine tasting booth going in, and taking the place of a farmer. And I can't talk any longer. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Minetta. Anyone else?
Hello to everyone. Shirley Gibson. I wondered if you could put back the little map that shows Olahana Alley, and then if you could give us the dimensions of what the wine tasting area would be. And I guess my concern would be, are we losing any fruit or vegetables or candy popcorn to the wine tasting?
So you were looking at where on
what are the dimensions of that space?
Okay. We'll see if we can get Peter back up here and answer that. Okay, what other questions?
And I think I prefer
everything would be inclusive in that particular area.
Well, let me ask a follow-up question then. Is it going to replace something that's already normally there during farmers market, or is it going to be in addition to?
Well, as it turns,
does something have to go?
Okay. So the answer is no, and this is the reason that we chose that particular spot, because of the way that bends out is that we can't have a farmer pull his truck in vertically like that. And so we have had a person who had been coming, and within about a 20 or 25-foot space, this is that he only used about 10 feet. And so we figured that's an ideal place to put the winery because it would not affect any other farmer. And then just as an added note, is that the wineries are farmers because these are estate wines, and so they are farmers themselves. They produce the grapes. They are the ones that make the wine as well. So they are farmers.
I have a follow-up, if I might.
Okay, go ahead.
Have you talked to any of the local businesses about whether they feel, unfair competition or anything like that by your being there? In other words, other outfits that sell alcohol?
I haven't myself gone through and asked any of the people. We feel that this is a 2.5-hour event, and we feel that any potential negatives there might be would be outweighed by bringing in more people who would be attracted to and then affect the economy in the village even more so.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
We lose a lot of those, so I'm glad you brought it back. I did have one follow-up question. Follow-up to the follow-up question. We're talking about a 3-ounce max.
Correct.
Okay. Last time I went wine tasting, they were getting thinner and thinner on the pours. So I'm assuming, since this is educational, that more than one wine would be for a total of 3 ounces, or is it going to be 3 ounces all one wine? How are they going to market this?
Okay, well, I really can't speak for the wineries myself, but from what I understand, this is that they have the option of serving 3 ounces, whether or not it's from a half an ounce per, but a total of 3 ounces total, whatever the variety or array they might have.
And I'm assuming because of this law is very specific in terms of the quantity that they would gauge their spouts, their pourers accordingly. They would be measured.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Just as an added note to that, from what I understand is that it's very common for the wineries now to have a specific little thing that only can dispense a certain amount.
Yeah.
And so that is, I guess, increases the accuracy that it would be no more than 3 ounces.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
I think just one last thing is that, since I'm up here and maybe taking advantage of the situation, is that we really feel is that there's really no need to have an additional condition that would either require the wineries to charge or not to charge. We believe it should be up to the winery.
Okay. Very good. Anyone else? Last chance. Okay, close public comment on this, and we will bring it back to the council. Start on my left, your right, with Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think I had one other question. Maybe I think Peter said, Kelly, these are local wineries. These are within San Luis Obispo County or Santa Barbara County?
San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County.
Okay, like what we talked about a couple months ago with the locally sourced vegetables and jam, et cetera. Okay. So I'm ready to move forward with this with the caveat, which is already in there, with the 3 ounces. As I said at home, I took a look at how small that is, and it is fairly small. I think that it is as long as it's done responsibly, I think it's nice to showcase our local wineries. I think it's outreach for them. Some of the wineries are out in the, not right in the middle of the town. And so if people know what's out there, I think it's nice to try to bring these people some business. And like Peter said, they are farmers. The charging or the not charging, I actually had an opposite opinion. I tend to think that if we charge or if they charge for the tastings, I feel like some people won't even partake in the tastings.
That would be a problem. It's more gifts like wine glasses given for free and things that wouldn't be, we're all about all the things for sale have to be locally made now, So that glass wouldn't have been locally made, so it goes against our own policy as well. But what you're talking about is just a reduction in cost. I don't see how that would be a problem.
Okay. I'm willing to forward this tonight. I don't see this as a competition issue. I don't think that any of the local businesses are going to lose any business from a winery providing these tastes. Matter of fact, they may, if we have some shops that do wine tasting, that may bring people into those shops also. So I don't think that that's a competition issue. I'm pleased that it's not going to displace any existing farmers or any agricultural products other than the wine, so I have no problem with that. And I think that leaving it up to the wineries with whether they're going to charge or not is probably fair. There'll probably be some sort of internal competition that will develop. If you've got a system, we're rotating the different wineries that come through. If some wineries are charging and others aren't, they, you know, that may compel them not to. I think that the market will adjust that. So I've got no problem, and I'll support this tonight.
Okay. Councilmember Brown.
I have nothing further to add. I would also support it.
Okay. And Mayor Pro Tem?
I also support it and am in favor of removing condition number four completely. It's an issue. At some point, we can always revisit it. I'll just add on the insurance. I don't see it actually as a requirement. I'm not sure that's how we would handle this. How do we handle the requirement of insurance? Is that somehow in their license, I'm going to guess, rather than in their CUP?
I believe it's in their underlying CUP, but I have some language that I'm a little concerned with the comment that Mr. Janke made that he's not sure that alcoholic beverage service is covered. So I do have language when you come to your motion.
I'll come to that, because I do think one of the things that the JPIA's notice kind of put out recently is that all cities should be reviewing their, well, people have had their insurance requirements in place for a long time, and that is something I think we probably in general need to take a look at, that times have changed and sometimes some of the liability amounts and the liability types of coverage really need to be updated to fit the modern times. But that's sort of a separate comment. But, yeah, I do think somewhere in here we should add that condition.
Okay. Is that it? All right. I'm looking at this in terms of past practice. And if you recall back during our centennial, in 2011, we actually suspended our regulation or ordinance for alcoholic beverages in Heritage Square Park for the summer concert series. And it was only that one park, and it was only during the summer concert, but at the same time, and it wasn't tasting, you could actually buy a full glass of wine. And I'm not quite sure, I think it was part promotional, part fundraising for the Centennial Committee to finance some of the other events. We have zero problems. It was fine. People were having a good time with the music, and they didn't overindulge. We didn't have any problems at all. So I'm not concerned about that. And in terms of their presence, number one, if you pick up any of our tourism brochures for Arroyo Grande and those areas around us, the first thing you're going to see are vineyards and information highlighting our wineries. I mean, that's who we are, at least some of what we are. So I think people, there's sort of an expectation that if you're going to be in a farmer's market, part of agriculture is are the vineyards. So I think a representation from the vineyards are fine, and it's up to the vineyard how they want to promote this. So if they want to charge, it's sort of up to them. If they're in the business of trying to educate people and promote their wines, and I think we should leave that up to them if they want to give people a free glass or however that works out. And aside from that, I'm, you know, ready to move forward as well. So if somebody wants to try a motion. Don't all jump in at once.
Mr. Mayor, I'll move an ordinance to the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande amending Title IX, Section 9.04020 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding wine tasting at certified farmers markets, with the additional language that the association provide assurance that their insurance coverage does cover the alcoholic beverage.
We'll tag that onto the CUP after you introduce the ordinance. So it's more appropriate as a condition on the CUP.
Okay. Well, then I'll just leave the ordinance as presented.
Okay. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Okay. Hearing no
one. Under said policy. That would be condition 7. And then I just want to clarify with regard to condition 4, I thought I heard at least 3 of you say you wanted to strike the second clause that reads, and shall not charge for instructional tastings. I believe the balance of 4 is part of the law itself, the limit on the amount.
And that's fine. I'll strike the language.
Okay. All right, everybody okay with that? Then Did you get your motion in there? And we have, who seconded?
This one, I don't know. I thought we're just...
I'll second it.
Okay.
Okay. Any other discussion? Roll call, please.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Burnage?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Peter, for being here and waiting. It's okay. I was just going to check in. So, yeah, we're going to take a about a five-minute necessity break. So council is recessed at this time. We'll be back soon.
Housing that is equitable for families of all income categories with an emphasis on infill development. On a regional level, the purpose of the housing element is to provide greater opportunities for residents to live closer to work. The housing element contains information about the needs assessment, which boils down to the city's fair share of the regional housing needs determined by the San Luis Obispo County Council of Governments, an analysis of the city's resources to aid housing development, which includes land availability, infrastructure, and financial resources, an analysis of constraints to housing development, including those imposed by the city in the form of regulations or also environmental constraints, a review of how well the city implemented its previous housing element update, and finally, the policy program, which is the core of the document that explains how we intend to meet our goals of providing sufficient housing according to our needs assessment. The document is organized with the goals, policies, and programs right up front, since this information is basically our action plan. The remaining chapters provide more of the background and supporting information, including demographics, housing characteristics, housing affordability, special housing needs groups, at-risk housing, housing resources, housing constraints, and review of our previous housing element. We are currently at the very beginning of the housing element review process. Any amendments that are made tonight will be incorporated into the draft and then sent to HCD for their initial review. We will then integrate any comments from HCD and bring the document back to Planning Commission and City Council for final review and adoption. It is expected that HCD will certify the document once the city takes final action, than we had last time.
As I mentioned, the goals, policies, and programs create the action plan of the housing element. Because most of the goals, policies, and programs from the previous cycle are still relevant, they have been retained. Several of the policies have been revised for clarity purposes or to update information, but we also added a few policies and programs, and these include establishing a program to provide assistance for first-time home buyers, monitoring the loss of permanent workforce housing from vacation rentals, amending the zoning ordinance to encourage farm worker housing, and amending the development code to define transitional and supportive housing as allowable residential uses. Program G1-3 was amended in response to City Council comments from the previous housing element update. This program previously stated that the city shall amend the development code to allow development of 5 or more multifamily attached units in the MF and MFA zoning districts with a minor use permit. The intent of this program is to remove obstacles to the provision of multifamily housing. Council was concerned about not having any oversight over the design of these large multifamily projects. Staff has therefore modified this program to state the city shall amend the development code to allow development of up to 15 multifamily attached units in the MF and MFA zoning districts with a minor use permit, subject to design review through the Architectural Review Committee. Development of over 15 multifamily attached units in these zoning districts would then require a CUP, conditional use permit. In summary, the housing element update provides the necessary conditions for producing and preserving an adequate supply of affordable housing, including special needs housing. It includes strategies that address the city's local housing needs, including an inventory of land adequately zoned for housing in all income categories, and a commitment to assist in housing development through regulatory concessions and incentives. State law requires jurisdictions to make a diligent effort to involve all economic segments of the community in the housing element update process. The public hearing process provides an opportunity for the public to identify problems and propose solutions to housing issues facing our city. By submitting the housing element to HCD, the city will be in compliance with the statutory procedure for adoption of an updated housing element. A certified housing element also makes the city eligible for state and federal grant funding. It should be noted that some of the policies identified encourage increased densities for infill sites and therefore could result in parking or other neighborhood issues related to future proposed projects. But although the housing element provides for policies to ensure there are adequate sites for housing, development of housing at maximum densities is not required, and all projects are, of course, subject to CEQA review. So, in conclusion, staff recommends that council review and receive public comment on the draft housing element update and make any adjustments that you deem necessary. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we start with questions? Go ahead.
A couple of quick questions for you, Kelly. One of the things that the, on page 283 of the staff report, which I believe is about page 112, 113 of the draft element, talks about water and the fact that if we are successful in our efforts to conserve water, we're going to have enough water in with our existing inventory to handle all of these housing units. Question I have for you is if we continue to go into a drought cycle, that calls into question the dependability of the level of water we're going to get out of groundwater in Lake Lopez. Are we locking ourselves, and I understand this just, the purpose of this document is simply to make sure we have the availability to build out this number of units. It doesn't mean we're going to be able to do that. It just means we have the ability in their inventory to do that. Are we in any way, shape, or form penalized by assuming we're going to continue to have the same level of water?
Well, I know with our general plan as it sits right now, we are okay water-wise at build-out. It's when we, you know, modify our general plan to include more density is when we run into issues. And like what we did with the annexation, you know, you have to show how you can offset
your water use. So,
well, I understand that.
Your question.
But I think the question I have is that we're continuing to make the assumption that we're going to have, and I'm just guessing off the top of my head, but it's like 3,880 acre-feet of water a year from groundwater in Lake Lopez. My question is, how adaptable can we be if it starts turning out in the next year or two or three that we don't have that level of water available?
The programs from the previous housing element are contained in this one. Remember, it's only been 9 months since we approved the last one, so we had to get busy doing an update, so we haven't been busy actually doing the amendments to the development code, but they are carryover programs, and if you look at the very beginning of, you know, all the different programs, A to N or whatever, they say exactly when they're supposed to be implemented.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Before I get to you, Tim, let me add something here. This has been a front burner item with the drought in California, and certainly, you know, with the League of Cities right now, there are a lot of people who are where we are right now with this housing element. And if you recall back when the housing laws were put in place, there was a lot of controversy about all of the numbers that we were getting from Department of Finance that said our population was going to double and triple and we better find houses for everybody. And, of course, that didn't happen. But the main issue here was that what you had to do was make a good faith effort to look at what a reasonable increase in your population would be in all of these income categories and plan to have space available for housing. And the condition was that there were mitigating circumstances, and certainly the nature of the drought and water availability is huge right now. The other thing that some cities are using is what the state did to us with the dissolution of redevelopment and not giving us access to tax increment financing. And so for a lot of housing projects, that put the brakes on their housing element and some of the goals that they were trying to achieve. So they're using that as kind of a mitigation factor as well. But I think what HCD wants to see is us making, number one, planning for it, and then making a reasonable attempt to meet those goals. But certainly things that get in our way are the lack of availability to finance and certainly lack of water, which a lot of people are using right now. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you stole my thunder, but that's okay. The reason this was kind of a hot-button issue for me is that we as a council, people on the council, have brought up HCD's requirements before and that we need to meet those requirements. And I was struck when we originally did it more just like you said, is we have to plan for it. That doesn't mean we can't have a common-sense approach and take constraints into place, water being one of them. So I guess my question is, has there ever been any penalty for not making your needs assessment goal? Has HCD or anybody else been told to, you know, find anybody or told some, you know, has there been penalties? I hear a big discussion about that we're going to get, you know, our hands whacked if we don't do this thing. But it seems to me more of a planning document than an actual enforceable, hey, if you don't do this, we're going to come after you.
The only thing that they have as not even leverage, it's more of a carrot, has to do with the grant funding. You need to have a certified element to receive certain types of grant funding for affordable housing. Other than that, yeah, there's no stick involved.
I guess that's my frustration, is I've heard public discussion about a lot of our housing situations where this is brought up, hey, we need to meet this. That's why we're doing bigger density. That's why we're doing this. And to me, that shouldn't be the overarching concern, that it truly is just a planning document. And unless it had some teeth where we would get fined or have some sort of consequences for it, I think we need to keep that in mind when we're talking about projects. I also want to compliment you on getting the change that was so frustrating for me last time, because I think it was backwards. I think the the language was backwards. I'm just curious how you came up with the 15 units versus, I think before it was 20 units. I'm just trying to figure out where you drew the line or how you drew the line or if you...
Hey, you know, if you want to draw the line someplace else, that's fine. It was pretty much staff just coming up with a number.
Okay. Yeah. So you think 15 units being developed and put in front of the city staff is something that you're comfortable handling at an administrative level?
Well, the thought was that if it goes to the Architectural Review Committee, it can be appealed right on up the chain, and council members can appeal it to the council, you know.
No, but I guess my question is, do you as a staff feel comfortable that if it's not appealed and it's put before the city, that you can handle all that without the other intervening steps that we've had before?
Well, I have...
I was going to say, I mean, most of those items are technical items the staff provide recommendations on anyways. It's, as Kelly said, the appearance is what we're most concerned about as far as making sure there is a neighborhood or community concerns, and that's why involving the ARC works well in that. And then if anybody's not satisfied, it can be appealed to the Planning Commission or the council. So we felt that covered all the bases, but open to other suggestions.
I was just going to presumptuously answer the question on behalf of the department and say yes.
That's the shortest answer I think I've ever heard you give. Mr. Mayor, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Council Member Barnage, any questions?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Kelly, on page 168, with the Planning Commission recommendation, they provided the following comments, and one of them was development projects should include a percentage of low and very low income units dispersed throughout the project. Unfortunately, I think usually we get the in-lieu fees. But if we're not going to have the in-lieu fees, this was already in. They're just sort of reiterating it because this is something that's been in there before.
Yeah, they just wanted to make that that was a concern, and I just wanted to emphasize that. And we already do that. The example is Ocean Oaks, which has a mix of low income and moderate income, and they're dispersed throughout. It's just that when to try to get low and very low income multifamily projects, really the only formula is with collaboration and using a nonprofit and going for tax credits and, you know, getting very creative in the financing, and you usually don't get a developer, you know, wanting. We usually get the in-lieu fee.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And then on, let's see, A15, the city shall pursue program assistance for first-time home buyers. What I mean, just sort of give me an idea what staff has thought about that should include some ideas.
Well, the county currently has a program, or they did have a program. We would pretty much copy what they did, since we've never done it before. We would have to really think it out, you know, determine where the assistance would come from. Would it be general fund? Would it be our in-lieu or in-lieu fees? That kind of thing. But it would have to be established. But we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel, though.
Okay. I think it's a good idea. I just was sort of curious how we would help facilitate that. And then I didn't write down the page number, but staff will monitor the loss of permanent workforce housing. Oh, I think that was in relation to the vacation rentals, because now we have the vacation rentals, so we feel maybe some of those granny units and such might go away. And what's staff's idea on how we can prevent that? You know, because we said you can have a vacation rental, so is there any other ideas?
I think it's just keeping track of what's going on and how many we're getting and just, you know, keeping a finger on the pulse for that particular program because it's new and we don't really know where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all that's saying.
Okay. Let's see. And then the farm worker housing. I have never heard of that before. What does that entail?
Well, it's going to be very low or extremely low-income housing, and it's usually within a certain distance of existing ag that they actually do the work on, provide the labor for existing ag close by.
Okay. Well, no. Let's see.
And this is to satisfy HCD, really?
I think those are my only questions. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
Yeah, I think most of the questions that I had have been, first of all, on the farm workers, I think we've had farm worker housing in this before. That's not a new piece. Is that a new piece to the housing?
It's not in our development code in the list of use in residential. It's not listed as a residential type.
As a resident, but it is permissible on existing ag land. I remember it's in our general plan.
Yeah, but we're just trying to get into the residential portion of the development code.
And then related to the, you know, the disbursement of units, and that's always been, you know, it may not have been in the last housing element, but it's certainly been in all of our development concepts, and yet in reality that's just never seems to materialize quite that way. Is that a requirement from the state, or is that just kind of a general way that we think it should be implemented?
It's not a requirement from the state. It's I think it's overall the thought of most jurisdictions and the state that it should not be concentrated so that it turns into a sore spot in the city, and that they don't, and that people who are renting or owning an affordable unit, you can't tell by the front that it's, you know, an affordable unit. They're all working on theirs or they're done. Yeah, they're all up to date.
Everybody else is up to date.
Yep.
All right, thank you.
A Atascadero is, we're right in line with Atascadero, I think, right now.
All right. This is a public hearing. If there's anyone in the audience who would like to come forward on this item, this would be your opportunity. Anyone?
My name is Leanne Akins. I'm a resident of Arroyo Grande. I just had a couple quick questions. I was curious. A few slides ago, there was a mention of adequate attempts, or at least an adequate number of units. I'm curious, who defines adequate, and what defines adequate in this case? I'm also curious, along the lines of questioning from the council in terms of the purpose of this. I think I'm looking at it incredibly differently. I think the purpose of a document like this is not only to plan, but to actually really show due diligence and follow through with part of that plan. I escaped from the Bay Area a little less than a year and a half ago. I resided both in the East Bay and on the peninsula. The communities that I lived in were not very good at ensuring adequate housing for low income or very low income. And while I understand that we as a community want to mitigate sore spots in our community, I also think that we need to do due diligence and work on providing housing for people who want to live here but who might not be able to afford to. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Okay, seeing no one else, we'll close the public hearing portion, and we will bring this back to the council. We'll start to my right this time with Councilmember Brown.
Well, I just want to comment on the comments that you just made, and part of my questioning and my frustration was that this was kind of shoved down our throat from the state of California at one point, and they said, you will do this. And I just bridle against anybody telling me I have to do something that doesn't seem part of our community. And I don't mean having low-income housing is not part of our community. It is. And I've been all for deed-restricted low-income housing for as long as I can remember, and anybody that knows my voting record knows that. But I have always been frustrated by the idea of, yeah, you have to do this, and then they don't tell you what the consequences are if you don't, and yet we continue to plan and do those things thinking that there's some penalty involved for not doing it, when I think really what we should be, the way we should be planning is not based on somebody telling us we need to build so many units, but rather do it because it's a good planning move. So I just want to mention that part of my, and I brought this up at a prior meeting that I wanted to talk about it, so I'm glad we are. Everything should be based on good planning and not based on some mandated regulation. That makes no sense to me. And so anyway, I'm ready to move forward. I appreciate the I appreciate the change that you made. I'm a little leery still based on the number, but I'm willing to see if it works. And I'm curious to see what's going to happen if we have to do a temporary building moratorium due to water, because if things don't change in the near future, we're going to be facing that whether we want to or not. And that's something we really haven't broached with the public and with the community, I think, as much as we need to, because we only have a couple of years of water left. And so, anyway, those are my comments.
Okay. Thanks, Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd like to go back and address a point you made also, Leanne. Yes, the state has dictated that we all have to put these plans together. And what the intent, as far as I'm concerned, the intent is that we do an inventory of the space available in our community where we can put in different kinds of developments. We make that available, and then it's up to the developers to come forward and develop on those properties. Unfortunately, the realities of it are that it's extremely expensive for a developer to do this. And we do have some programs. We partnership with People's Self-Help Housing, and in that way, some of these projects will get completed. So I think we're doing a good thing here. I think we're taking steps that, yeah, we're being forced to do them on one level.
Mr. Mayor, I don't have a lot to add. I'll support it as well. I like the comments that Planning Commission have made and some of the changes that staff has made. It was interesting to read about the median income. The figure was old. I think it was from 2010. But the median income for Roy Grande for a household was $58,725. And I think for two people living in a Roy Grande to be able to buy a house, I don't think that's a lot of money. And so I would come back to, it actually was brought up at the candidates forum, that our demographics don't necessarily show or suggest that we need high-density housing. And I think that that's an assumption out there, that only people that make, you know, over $100,000 live in a Roy Grande and they can only afford it. And I think a lot of these people that make a lot less would love to live in a Roy Grande. And I think those high-density projects that we don't see all the time are really, really important. And as we move forward, I hope that, I mean, there's a couple potential projects coming through with some vacant land. We don't have a lot of vacant land left. But I think that our median income definitely shows in Roy Grande that we need some high-density housing. That's the only way it's going to be affordable for these people. And I would also add that I think a lot of people that can afford something more that's not high density, they want high density because they don't want to take care of a yard in a big house. Retired couples, people that don't live here all the time, that might have another house someplace else. So I hope that we see more projects like that. I know always high density isn't a buzzword that everyone loves to live next to high density, but I think that even planners that work for our city, they would love to live here, and unfortunately we don't get a lot of real estate built with them in mind. So those are my only comments. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem?
Well, I don't have a lot to add here. I just wanted to comment real quickly on the question about burden on staff as far as the 15 units goes. I mean, in reality, staff does the majority of this work almost all of this work, and the fact that it doesn't go to Planning Commission, I think, if anything, would reduce staff time on these kinds of projects. I think one of our goals was to have the potential, before one of these just flows through the system, that somebody somewhere is going to take a look at it, whether it's design or whether it's other issues that might be there. I think that was what we were trying to accomplish by having go to architectural review. I think we have plenty of adequate protection. It's always scary when you approve these things and there's all these numbers, and you know, when you start adding in the bonus units for, you know, for affordable housing, all of a sudden some of these numbers can get really big. But there are still the basic resource constraints that are out there that make these what would seem like massive, super high density units just not practical. They're also just not practical from a financial standpoint. It's not like there are people waiting in line here to build apartment units with high densities in our community, let alone what the political aspect of that might be. The reason I commented on the dispersing units, because we do see this, I've now seen this for what, 12 years, as long as I've been on here, is it just doesn't fit the reality of the way affordable housing gets built, at least in our community. I mean, the reality is that most of the affordable housing has been built in relatively large blocks, not dispersed through communities. And I'm not really suggesting that we go back and rewrite this, but it's something we consider for the next time around. Is really something more like, you know, there was one time one of the developers wanted to build an affordable housing unit and then be able to bank those units to be able to use them in future projects. I do think that actually, in retrospect, that's an idea that actually has some merit. If we really want to see, it takes affordable housing and puts the potential for developers, what I'll call regular market rate of developers, to build them probably really more efficiently than most of the nonprofits that do it now. And provide those units. They may not provide it exactly the way that ideally we would all like it to be, but the way that practically it's going to be, I think, is that's something we should be looking at in the future. I think the other deal is that to consider that the concern that we're going to have some sort of a slum development developed here is legitimate. But when you look at the reality of the affordable housing we have developed, very few people would know, if you drove around the city, the affordable units, which ones they are. You know, if we all know where they are because, you know, we're fairly familiar with them, but most people wouldn't even know the affordable units that have been built in our community. I just think that's something we ought to consider for the future. But I do know we got to get in the cycle, and I'm not quite sure why, but, you know, we do need to get on with this, because we may be another couple of years getting this approved the way the state moves. Actually, I think there ought to be some penalty maybe for the state here for not being able to approve these. I think I said that last time. But at any rate, I'm
North and Santa Barbara County on the south, and they were all going to come to San Luis Obispo, and they were going to come in by the tens of thousands. And we had to provide all of this housing. And the you know, you remember the first round arena numbers we got was just totally unrealistic. And, of course, none of those predictions came true. And, in fact, during that period of time, some of our cities actually lost population. So San Luis Obispo County, those numbers came through the Council of Governments. We actually went up to Sacramento as a COG, and I think I was vice president of the COG at that time, and I went up with Shirley Bianchi and a couple of others, and we met with HCD. And just simply told them this is unrealistic. There's no way we can do this. And so they wound up modifying it down, not by much, but the only fallback position was they said you only have to plan to build them, and of course, you know, you don't have to actually build them if you can't do it. And the other thing that made them back off was that we started raising the whole issue of an unfunded state mandate. And that's essentially what it was. They were taken away, and now it's even more so with redevelopment going away. So you know, getting back to this, you know, the stick issue, they've come down. They've taken several deep breaths and have come down a long, long way. And what they do now is essentially treat these things on a case-by-case basis. And most of the time, I don't know what your experience has been, Kelly, but they've been fairly reasonable to deal with if they see that you're making a good faith attempt. I don't think any of us can argue with the fact that the big stick is the fact that if they look at your housing element, and of course they're going to consider the mitigating circumstances like drought and problems with financing and all of those other kinds of things, but if they see year after year after year where you're not making any headway at all, you haven't satisfied any of your goals, that tells them that you're not trying, or maybe you don't think it's important. And when you get to that point, they will call you on it, and they will probably give you some specific time frames where they want to see some progress. So that's pretty much where they're at right now. On the affordable housing issue, and I think I've had a couple of conversations on that. This has been a challenge from day one. We seem to have the best outcome with inclusionary housing, and you're right. Some of the affordable units that we see, some of the affordable housing, they may be smaller in their footprint, but in terms of amenities, a lot of the builders, a lot of the local developers have done a good job with them. You walk in there, and you would be blown away with how nice those houses look. The problem that we've always had with affordable housing is keeping them affordable, and that has been the challenge. And it's a challenge here with, we're going to indicate how many affordable housing units we have. The problem is when you have a lot of density and smaller units, the price goes down, but the people who really need to move in there don't have a fair opportunity or a fair shot at it because you get a lot of investors, you get a lot of people who have a lot of money, and they go in and scoop those things up. And then instead of selling them, they rent them, and they rent them at a higher rate. They're in the business to make money. And, we tried to regulate that. We tried to legislate in our own city codes using guidance from the state on how we could keep affordable units affordable, and the conditions associated with that don't promote interest in that because it limits the amount of equity. You get somebody that's down here on the income level, they want to build themselves up. And the way that they do that is with equity buildup in their home. If they can get in at a low price and build equity, they can afford a better home. But the restrictions on this was such that they weren't allowed to build up equity because they had to keep it in the affordable classification. So we were getting, and then the market rate came down to the affordability rate there for a while. And so you couldn't tell the difference. And they were going out and buying market rate homes. So so that continues to be a challenge. And I think it always will. We can do the best we can and provide the inventory. But whether we're able to actually get it to the people who need it and whether we're actually able to keep it in that affordable classification will continue to be a challenge. So I think you've done a good job here. We obviously need to get this housing element. COG meeting last time out, we had three public hearings, and they were all on amending. We actually had three separate amendments to the FTIP, which is a Federal Transportation Improvement Plan. None of our projects were affected. We're still good to go. And then we had a few amendments to the RTP, which is the Regional Transportation Plan. We had an update on rideshare. It was a good. It's a good program, part PR and part functional program. And then I brought along copies, and I'm sorry, but I left them in my car, but I'll put them in your mailbox. The COG published its annual report, and it's really a nice document. It's not what you might think. It's not a thick text document. It's kind of a fold-out, and it shows the 101 main line through our county, and it shows all of the projects and the funding for it, and of course, Briscoe is in there, and so it's a good picture-oriented, illustrated document that everybody can kind of get a hold of fairly easily, so I'll bring a copy of that. And then Regional Transit Authority met. It was largely centered around the increases. Tanya was here and explained the increase to runabout. So there were a lot of questions on that and where we were going to conduct the town hall meetings and so on and so forth. South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District, we did meet, and update on the kind of the other half of 8C that we had on our consent agenda this evening. and really excited about that. We did have a little bump in our affluent for one day. Period of the day went up above the permit requirements. Communicated it right away to the Regional Water Quality Control Board. Just as soon as it went up, it came back down, and it was just kind of a nobody knows what happened. Something decided it wasn't going to work for a few minutes. But and we haven't had a repeat of that, so Regional Water was fine with it. And that's pretty much it for me. And we'll go to Mayor Pro Tem.
Mine will be quick. South County Area Transit has not met since my last report. EVC was also quiet in August, so there's no report there. California Joint Powers Insurance with the JPIA, as I noted, they had a, in their last flyer, had noted that the releases should be taking a look at their current liability requirements for, you know, all the way from recreation all the way through everything, because a lot of them have not been reviewed lately, and I don't know whether we have or not, but I do think that's something we ought to take a look at. And I did attend this month one of the South County South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District. And again, there was at that particular time there were no issues there at all. Very short. Thank you.
Let's see, who's next? Councilmember Costello.
The APCD meets bimonthly, and tomorrow is the next meeting, so we haven't had a meeting for a couple months, so there's nothing to report there. In terms of Five Cities Fire Authority, a couple of things significant. The SAFER grant has expired, and we had to lay off the six employees that were hired under that, and they've been let go. At this point, the federal government has not brought forward the SAFER grant application period to try to reinstate it. Because of the sequester, the federal government has fallen way behind in going forward with a lot of their grant application processes. So by now we would have been well into it, but it hasn't even opened yet, so we're on hold for that. The way we're going to cover the loss of the six employees as permanent employees is with reserve firefighters, as we do often anyway. I asked specifically about the six individuals that are laid off, are we keeping them as reserves? And the answer is yes, but they're not going to be working a great deal because economically they need unemployment, the unemployment benefits they get. If they work too much, then they lose those, and they can't work enough as reserves to compensate the balance off. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation, but we do have them back in the reserve pool, so we've got them. And we're going to be staffing out the stations, all three stations, Royal Grande, Grover Beach, and Oceano, using reserves, which is a continuation of policies we've used in the past. And hopefully the SAFER grant application period will open soon. We'll get that in, and we'll see if we can be successful with getting that. But we have to look at some long-term solutions to this. We have to look at some long-term solutions.
Regarding the RAC, we're still dealing with the EIR, with the ag cluster at Letitia, and as you well know, that's a hot-button issue regarding circulation and water. Elsewhere, just anecdotally, you all know that COTCHO got the bill through regarding the special water district up in the Paso area, and I'm interested to see that how that all pans out. It's going to be an interesting to see if how smoothly that flows. I still have some concerns because there's a lot of angst up there about moving forward with that and whether it's fair. But it's fascinating to me that the farming community for a long time was kind of hands-off regarding water issues and didn't want to get politically involved, and boy, are they involved now. So that's my report.
Okay, very good. Councilmember Barnich.
Let's see. Actually, everybody met this. We met, I think, all in one day or two day, all my boards. So Zone 3 met, the Low Reservoir Response Plan, otherwise known as the LRRP, has been completed by the county and the TAC members, and it will be coming to our council, I think Jeff said, tentatively on October 14th. So then all the agencies will take a look at that, and then it will go back to the Zone 3 board. And basically, just breaking that down, when Lopez Lake hits 20,000 acre feet of water, you know, give or take, if it's raining that day a lot or if it's not raining that week, you know, it's going to go into effect. And for Roy Grande residents, what we had just seen at council, we won't really, the stage one of that, when it hits the 20,000 acre feet, we'll sort of be on alert, and we won't, you know, we'll just be, you know, hopefully we'll all be conserving even more. Until it hits 15,000 acre feet, there won't be actual reductions, and those reductions are the reductions we talked about, the stage one, the historical use, and the stage two, which is the household allocation. Right now, Lopez is about 46% full, 22,586 acre feet. So probably they estimate beginning of December it will hit that 20,000 acre feet for the to trigger the LRRP. Hopefully, we're sort of moving this through the councils, get it back to Zone 3, get it to the county, so we can be prepared if we don't get this huge rainfall that we think we might get or we hope we might get. Now the Weather Service, they brought some graphs to the Zone 3 meeting. They're not predicting supposedly a big El Nino. It's called a baby El Nino. And then if you look at the graphs and the diagrams of the United States, the above normal rainfall, it sort of stays outside of the Central Coast, unfortunately. It's more north, or it's more south. So hopefully we'll get some of that rain, and maybe we can, you know, push off the LRRP. But I think that, especially Roy Grande, I think that Jeff's done a real good job of sort of staying ahead of the game, and we have things in place that we can do if it unfortunately we have to go to that. Just real quickly, like I talked about the LRRP, phase one, we're on alert, phase two, 15,000 acre feet, and it's a 10% reduction that's released to the agencies, and phase three, in Lopez Lake, 10,000 acre feet, and that's a 20% reduction, what's released to the agencies. So it's fairly significant, a little bit scary. The Tourism Marketing Committee met, and I'm unfortunately have to report that there's going to be a premiere of the chicken video at the Harvest Festival. They thought that would be so great let's not release it now. Let's wait, and we'll do it. Is it going to be on that big screen at Nelson Green or something?
Yes, it's going to be right before the movie night. As part of the movie night, it's going to be the lead-in.
Did you do this?
I did not. I'm not responsible for this, although I was present at the meeting.
So so that will take place, and I think it's a... it was posted to my Facebook page, or I was tagged in it or something. I left it on there. I was tempted to delete it. But anyway, we're in there. So that's what we talked about at that meeting. And then the Homelessness Services Oversight Committee met, the HSOC, and we did a couple things, amended some bylaws, restructured some committees. They've collected $8,700 from the parking meters that are in San Luis. So that's a nice chunk of change that wasn't there before. And then there's a 50 Now campaign with the county where they're trying to put the 50 most vulnerable people into home.
Push for Harvest Festival, and hopefully everybody's participating in the parade. Saturday, all the normal events that we, or most of the normal events will be there. Friday, we're making a particular push for Friday night activities this year. Besides the debut of the film, we've added a lot of lights and really lighting up the place. And then we have a really good special band we're bringing in from outside the area that'll be very entertaining. So, Friday night, in addition to the fish fry and all the other normal things, should be a lot of fun. So we're encouraging everybody to try to come out and enjoy both days of the festival.
And I understand we have a council member participating in the grape stomp this year.
Really?
Is that true?
Uh-huh. Yep.
All right.
Happy to do it.
Okay.
Something fun.
All right. Very good. And I'm assuming all of us are going to be in the parade.
What's the
Braden? Okay. All right. Okay, moving on to item 15. This is our final community comments and suggestions. Anyone want to come forth for this one? Okay, seeing no one, we'll close that. Item 14, closed session. We have none, and that will take us to adjournment. Thanks, everybody. We are adjourned.
I'll talk to you next day or two about it.